Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to film sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosie. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Well, friends, because last week was marks the anniversary of Elvis Presley's death, I'm going to replay part one of my epic two-part chat about the films of Elvis Presley with John Krull, the host of No Limits here at 90.1. And McKenna Mays is our moderator for that, of course. And then, of course, I'll play part two next week. But we'll get to that. But first, in theaters, if you don't want to go see Happy Land Murders or you know, if you have not seen an action movie with puppets and if you've not seen sex scenes involving puppets, well, there you go. But at your local art house theater, there's a little film opening called Puzzle, which you shouldn't miss. And it stars Kelly MacDonald. Now, Kelly MacDonald made her film debut in 1996 with Trainspotting. And since then has been a very solid that girl, that lady. She other notable credits include Gosford Park. She was the voice of Marita in Brave. She played Josh Brolin's wife in No Country for Old Men. And this is a showcase for her. And I'm really happy that she gets a chance to do a film like this. She plays a wife and mother in the suburbs of New York State. We're not quite sure where, but you have to take the train into the city. The husband is a mechanic. The sons may or may not be following in the dad's footsteps, but she has a very complacent life. She knows her place. She works with the church organization. She takes care of the family. She even prepares her own birthday cake for her own birthday party. One of those families. But we find out early on that she's got a very knack skill of solving jigsaw puzzles at a fast rate. And one day going into the city, she winds up meeting a total stranger and connecting with him because of the one thing they have in common is putting puzzles together fast. And there is a puzzle competition. Yes, there is. So it's a chance for an introvert to come out of her shell. And it's a nice understated performance from Kelly MacDonald. The gentleman that she winds up gaining a friendship, or is there more, is Indian actor Irfan Khan. Hope I'm saying that right. You know him as the police inspector from Slumdog Millionaire. He was in Jurassic World. He's also a that guy. And they get some really nice, low-key chemistry together. And when you think it's going to go in certain directions, well, this is not a big-budget Hollywood blockbuster. So doesn't quite go down the path you expect, and it's better. It's all the better for it. But yeah, that is opening in theaters this weekend. Go check that out. It's really nice. Okay, and that's really the only thing I got to see this week. Nothing wrong with that. New on Blu-ray this week is Deadpool 2. Did you really need it? That's what I thought. And one of the best films of 2018, Paul Schrader's First Reform, the megachurch and small church drama with Ethan Hawke, Amanda Seyfried, and Cedric the Entertainer. It's Paul Schrader's best film in years. Really solid performance from Ethan Hawke. I'm directing a play that opens in Richmond, Indiana, Richmond Civic, on September 14th and 15th. Also set in a mega church. Excuse me. And this film resonated with me before even going into rehearsals for this. It's a small town pastor who is questioning his faith after meeting a new congregant who has extreme environmental attitudes. And Hawke's character digs at it. And with Paul Schrader, if you need a story of a man going down a downward spiral, the man who wrote Taxi Driver, the man who directed Hardcore, Blue Collar, Affliction, adapted The Last Temptation of Christ, Light Sleeper, that fits. This film fits right into that category. So go check that out on video. All right. Now, at the Tibbs Drive-In, Screen 1, Happy Time Murders, and Mile 22. Sure. Screen 2, Slender Man and Equalizer 2. All right. Screen 3, The Meg and the First Purge. And then Screen 4, Christopher Robin and AXL. I don't know anybody who's seen AXL. Have you? And then over at the Tibbs this weekend, I'm sorry, that's at the Tibbs. At the Skyline is, if you're listening to this on Saturday, you have the second night of the Super Monster Movie Fest starting. Gates open at 5, opens at 7. Carrie Ray will be performing. Sammy Terry will be there at 9 o'clock. Carrie Ray performing at 8:15. Creature from the Black Lagoon at 10:30. Jaws at 1:30 a.m. Leviathan at 3:30 a.m. And Humanoids from the Deep at 5 a.m. Wow. And Sammy Terry apparently will be performing at 11 o'clock in between Creature from the Black Lagoon and Jaws. So if you're up all night for that, go check that out over in Shelbyville. At IU Cinema, again, if you're listening to this on Saturday, good for you. Thank you. At 4 o'clock, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And at 7 o'clock, the film musical version of Hair. And apparently, Twilight Harp Dance Company dancers Richard Colton and Sean Stevens will be at that screening. Sunday the 26th at 1 o'clock, Young Marks. Monday the 27th at 7 o'clock, Blow Up. Thursday the 30th at 7 p.m., Under the Tree, also playing on Friday, August 31st. And then mark your calendars for Thursday the 6th at 5 o'clock, The Films of Brinton with DJ accompaniment. On Friday the 7th, The Bigamist at 7 p.m. and The Last Unicorn at 10 p.m. And then Saturday, September 8th, The Land Before Time at 4 and Born in Flames at 7. And Loving Vincent, Sunday, September 9th, along with A Place in the Sun at 4 o'clock. At the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, E.T. is being shown tonight at 7:30 p.m., and then there will be an ASL pre-show interpretation and an open caption screening of E.T. Sunday at 2 p.m. Best in Show, Thursday, August 30th. That's a benefit for the Humane Society of Johnson County. Friday and Saturday, September 7th and 8th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. Wow, fast turnaround. Gone with the Wind. So all of those are happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. All right, ladies and gentlemen, get ready for this. This is part one of my breakdown of the films of Elvis Presley. I'm discussing this with John Krull, the host of No Limits here at WFYI, who is a bigger Elvis fan than I. McKenna Mays is moderating. So, to acknowledge the anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley. Enjoy. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very special edition of Film Sociology. John Krull, the host of No Limits, is here with me, as well as McKenna. And we are going to break down for you, the Film Sociology public radio listener, every film Elvis Presley ever made. So get ready, get your notebooks, find your top three. We're going to start at the very beginning, but I guess I should start with John. Where did your Elvis fandom begin?
Well, it was odd. It started when I was a small child. And I'm going to date myself here. The
producers, you didn't see Ed Sullivan.
No, I did not. But this is in Marion, Ohio, where we were. My family was living at the time when I was about 8 years old. It was the first time I was allowed to stay up late on a Friday night to watch a movie, and it was an Elvis movie, Tickle Me.
Oh, jeez.
Which, you know, again, though, there's an interesting story there. And, you know, from that point on, I was interested in it. And, you know, as I grew older, I really became fascinated by his music and you know, his range as a performer.
Yep. I thank/blame my mother. She was a huge Elvis fan. I remember being the one to tell her that there was a breaking news story back in 77 when he passed. I've always said that besides Elvis being one of the great entertainers, period, he's also one of the great show business what could have been's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he'd
as much as he accomplished, there's a whole lot more, whole other levels
if
there.
If he had bopped Colonel Parker on the head and actually toured the world and had rights to his songs and made maybe a third less films, I mean, the possibilities were kind of endless in his case.
Yeah, and that's I assume that's the sort of stuff we're going to talk about. But it sort of culminated, too. You mentioned him dying in 77. My other great connection is I saw the last show.
Yes, you did.
I was there at Market Square Arena.
Willie Mays with the Mets?
Well, actually, my take on that was different because I went in there, you know, I knew he, even I think I was 18 at the time, not quite 18. I went to the show realizing, okay, this guy's not 22 years old anymore. He's not the hillbilly cat. He's not any of those things. And I've got to say the performances I recall of him singing a couple of the later songs, Hurt and Bridge Over Troubled Water, were incredibly moving, incredibly powerful performances. Did he walk through a lot of the early hits? You bet.
Oh, yeah.
You bet.
1 minute, 20 second like, versions of Hound Dog.
Yeah. And you could tell he was bored with it, but which became kind of a, you know, is a theme we probably will explore in the discussion here,
well,
too.
My only comparison I think of that, I never got to see him. We had a chance to get tickets to see him New Year's Eve 1976.
Oh, the famous show
there. At
the
Pontiac Silverdome, and it just did not happen.
Yeah.
But I think of like when I saw Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry at the Chicago Blues Festival. This was in the late 90s, early aughts, and when they were on, they were on. And if they weren't, it was like Shaq at the free throw line. It was, you know, a very loud clang. So you kind of had to take the bitter with the sweet, I guess, in those cases.
Yeah. The difference between Elvis and Chuck is that I remember seeing a Chuck Berry show where literally he put down his guitar and started berating the audience.
Yeah,
Elvis never crossed that line.
Although, if you go on YouTube, there are some rants.
Yeah.
There are. But, you know, they never...
Not rarely directed toward the audience.
No, though. They were toward the evil media that is us.
Yeah.
But yeah, those somehow did not wind up on the RCA album, Having Fun with Elvis on Stage. Ladies and gentlemen, there is an entire RCA album of Elvis talking to the audience.
Saying thank you. Thank you very much, basically.
For 38 minutes.
Yeah, it's really not memorable.
and if you look at those 70s albums, that's saying a lot. So.
Yeah, well, and that illustrates one of the problems. My understanding of that, too, is that that wasn't technically an RCA thing.
Oh.
The Colonel put that out through his own label as a side deal to make money himself, in part because he was... You know, if the reporting I've read is accurate, he was deeply in hock in Vegas because of his gambling problem. So
yeah.
So
anyway, all right. With that in mind, let's start to break down the entire Elvis filmography. You're welcome, McKenna. Start us off. Where we begin? I know where we're beginning, but you're moderating this, so go ahead.
All right, we're gonna start off with 1956, "Love Me Tender."
Well.
It was not an Elvis vehicle. It turned into one.
It did, in part because they wanted to graft some songs onto it.
It was, I think, the Reno Brothers was the original title.
It was the original title. And, you know, the amazing thing there is that it really was sort of a B-Western that became this huge cultural phenomenon at the time because he was so big. You know, that's something in this age that we have trouble capturing because our, you know, our media, our culture, all of that have become much more fragmented, yep. much more compartmentalized. We can't even process something as big as Elvis or the Beatles anymore. In 1956, the year that Love Me Tender came out, he sold one out of every nine records sold in the world.
Period. Fathom that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's like saying, you know,
yeah.
1956 dollars.
Yes. Sort yeah. No, I mean, it's huge, which means that the, you know, I can't even think of, you'd have to combine about six or seven different performers to have that impact now.
I think an attempt where they tried to do that, and this is a bad example, and it's a, but it's being able to cash in on somebody, is something like from Justin to Kelly.
Yeah.
The American Idol beach movie, because American Idol at that time was red hot, and they tried to capsize on that, and the results were mid-60s level at best, and that's not a compliment.
Yeah. The amazing thing, and you see all of really the good stuff and the bad stuff that would come from that first performance. I mean, there is a tremendous presence on
yes.
the screen. You cannot avoid watching the guy. When he's there, you can tell he is untrained as
yep.
an actor,
or it was really like raw.
Yeah,
and he loved yeah. James Dean. He thought he could be or want to be like a James Dean type actor. Came
yeah.
close a couple times, but
he did, and we'll get to those. But you know, in some of it though, even that was sort of a false trail for him because,
yep.
Dean was Dean, and he had his own private demons and all of that sort of stuff that he was able to communicate. You know, Elvis's gifts were a little bit less tortured than Dean's. He was somewhat less confused, I think. And, you know, the other thing is that, you know, places where he had success was really blazing his own trail, not trying to be an imitation. You know, you look at the music, he takes a Big Boy Crudup song,
yep.
and you listen to the original, and you listen, it's not an imitation of the blues.
No.
He's made it something else entirely different. And, you know, by trying to be James Dean, he was working himself into a box when a large part of his career was about kicking the walls of the box down.
Very good, exactly. And again, it's a good Western. It's a decent Western. It's more interesting when he's, like you said, when he's on screen because of that dynamic yeah. and what he was
Richard,
going to do.
Richard
with it.
Egan does not really radiate magnetism.
Exactly. All right. I don't have a bell. I don't have a chime. But here we go.
Okay.
All right. Next.
Right. 1957. Loving You.
And this is like this is one of the quintessential 50s kind of troubled teen films, because now you had films like Rock Around the Clock and you know, where you were incorporating rock and roll music into movies. And I mean, and this would go even further in the late 60s, but the troubled teen who becomes a star, and he winds up doing a couple of these. But this one's, I like this one as well.
Well, and really, this one and then the next two, Jailhouse Rock and King Creole, are in some ways variations of his own story.
Yes.
You know, it's about Elvis by another name becoming Elvis, you know, becoming
the capital E.
The star. The thing that I find interesting about Loving You is I think that is most likely the closest we got on screen to what the stage performances were like at the time, to
yep.
what, because even in Jailhouse Rock or King Creole, the performances are highly stylized.
Yes.
You know, in part because there were, Hal Cantor, I think actually, who directed Loving You, saw it as part of his mission to capture some of the Elvis phenomenon. He went down there, and I think he lived with Elvis for about a week and drove around with him and saw some of the performances and thought, okay, I want to capture as much of this energy as I can get on screen. So that's what makes it interesting. And then the other model that disappeared, I think, later in the film careers, there's a solid supporting cast there, too. Some very talented, Elizabeth Scott, you know, Wendell Corey, you know, talented people.
And we're going to get to those, especially especially when we get into the 60s, about who he had off coming off the bench.
Yeah.
I like to mix my sports with my arts. All right.
Yeah.
Next.
Same year, 1957, Jailhouse Rock.
Not a bad year.
No.
Of course, the famous title track, which he did the choreography for, although he never had stage dancers on stage.
It actually had been choreographed. The choreographer said, show me some of the moves you use on stage, and then I'll build a routine.
So he gets the second half of the and credit.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, and it's also one of the few, if not the only, Elvis performance or movie where for the bulk of the film he's supposed to be deliberately unlikable.
Right.
You know, he is a hardened jerk through much of the movie, and that you know, in some ways that becomes a theme in the films too, that the bad boy has to be tamed.
I have to kill my phone.
That's
This is actually happening as we know it. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
You were saying, John, so sorry.
That's okay.
This is your pledge dollars at work, folks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as I say, he was the bad boy who had to be tamed. And, to me, has been one of the weaknesses of that film, is that it is a surly kind of drama with some great songs, perhaps if not the greatest score in the Elvis film canon, certainly one of them. And then at the end, it gets really, really saccharine.
It's still a 50s film.
It is, yeah.
All right. Next.
1958, King Creole.
This is probably my favorite.
It is mine, too.
It is directed by Michael Curtiz, the man who gave us Casablanca, among other things. You have Carolyn Jones, Walter Matthau, Vic Morrow. That's a strong supporting group.
Dean Jagger.
It's about as close to noir as Elvis is going to get. And same thing. Kind of a troubled guy who becomes a singer, but gets pulled into the seedy underworld of show business in New Orleans. And it's the combination of, I think, his acting and music performances are some of the best.
Yes, I would agree that, you know, the reason I was chuckling is I remember when I was in grad school and talking with some friends who were film buffs too, and they made reference to the fact that Michael Curtiz directed this one and talked about Casablanca and Yankee Doodle Dandy, and then I said King Creole, and history will have to judge which was the best. At which point the conversation just descended from there.
And Milos Forman directed Hair.
So, but this one I think is also part of what the music is fabulous. The supporting performances are really exceptionally strong. It's also, I think, the most vulnerable we ever see Elvis on camera. There is a part of him, in part because he wanted to project that tough guy, surly. He wanted to be, you know, Dean or Brando, and I don't think he necessarily saw the vulnerability in either of those actors, too. But he wanted to project that kind of masculinity that he didn't do wounded all that often or do it all that well.
Right.
And in this, we see that. We see regret. And, of course, Curtiz makes beautiful use of the New Orleans location.
And that was a film I think around the same time, Panic in the Streets was a film that was shot down there. Also beautiful black and white. But, yeah, that was a city that wasn't, I don't think, utilized as much cinematically then.
Well, and I love that opening scene where he's standing on the balcony in the French Quarter and, you know, they sing the song Crawfish. But there is just something about it that is so evocative and so hypnotic almost.
And I think we can break down Colonel Parker, who to blame on where the path could have gone cinematically, but that was a pretty high point. And
He was poised for a major film career at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so with that in mind, next.
1960 G.I. Blues.
Okay. Yeah.
This is where it begins to jump the rails.
Because we have to make fun of him being in the army and Juliet Prowse is in it. So she's, I mean, by this point we get to how good is the female, and that's a terrible thing. How good is the foil? How good, if there is one, of the comedic sidekick? Forget music or storyline or anything else. It's like who is he working with, and does it help? Prowse is good. As far, I think she's one of the better.
Oh, and they had real sparks. Mm-hmm. I gather they had an affair too while they were making the movie. But you know, some of that is true. I think there was also a conscious attempt. What we need to remember is that the rock and roll was still very much in its infancy at that point, and you know, at least in show business. Everyone was convinced that this was a fad, that it was going to disappear, and that, you know, Elvis was kind of a cash cow who, you know, if he was going to outlive the fad, they had to try to transform him Correct. Into something else, you know, and what they were looking at was really trying to achieve a lighter, younger Dean Martin or
something like
presence
that.
Like that, where he is this, you know, charming ladies guy who sings a few songs. And they saw the movies also as vehicles for selling the records.
Of course.
And all of that. You know, of these films, that's part of what went on there. But I don't think we can let Elvis entirely off the hook
no.
on that, because he was 25 at the time. He was old enough to assert some control over what he was doing, and even when he had if you want to do something instructive, Blue Suede Shoes was re-recorded for the G.I. Blues soundtrack. Listen to the original recording that he did in 56, listen to the one he did in 60, and then listen when he revisited in the 68 comeback special. And you can tell, there's a valley there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really did not care at all, didn't put any of the fire into it.
And we start shoving him into a studio with studio musicians who may or may not have the rock savvy, but they could play anything.
Well, and some of that also was the, you know, the contempt for what he was doing on the part of Hollywood. You know, the musicians, even going back to Love Me Tender, mm-hmm. the people who were backing him, you know, his original group of Scotty Moore and Bill Black and DJ Fontana auditioned to be his backup band in Love Me Tender, and the producers said, "No, you're not country enough." So instead, they got Hollywood studio musicians, who were all but wearing sunglasses during a 1860 Civil War drama.
Right,
but,
exactly.
Yeah.
And by the way, remember, McKenna, as Bruno Kirby said in Spinal Tap, this is a fad.
So, yeah.
I know. That's unfortunate. All right, next.
1960, Flaming Star.
Another good director. It's Don Siegel. He had already done Invasion of the Body Snatchers and would later work with Clint Eastwood famously in Dirty Harry, Escape from Alcatraz, Coogan's Bluff.
And actually acted for Eastwood
and
Play Misty for Me, played the bartender,
that's
if
right.
I remember correctly.
And
yeah.
This was the guy who had a reputation of getting, and kind of Clint would also imitate it, get it in on time and under budget, and they for the most part would leave you alone. And Barbara Eden was in it. I always had a soft spot for Barbara Eden, and this was kind of a serious Western where he played the, for lack of a better term, the half-breed who has to decide which side he's going to fall upon.
Yeah, for it's very much a product of that period. I mean, there are civil rights implications there too. A statement about prejudice. Long before it got to Elvis, I think it was originally conceived as a vehicle for Brando, and you know, they worked their way down the pecking order,
right.
as it were. At that time, but he turns in, you know, a really credible performance. You get the sense, and I think it was Pauline Kael who said, if he had used this in King Creole as building blocks, he could have had a serious film career. And you always get the sense that was the ambition.
Mm-hmm.
He originally had not wanted to even sing in the movies, and because he had contempt for the musical as an art form, but that's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
And all of that, and, you know, found quickly that nobody, at least initially, was going to pay him at least the sums that Colonel Parker was asking for if he wasn't going to sing.
Yeah, so, that's unfortunate.
And they shoehorned. You know, the one weakness to that film, it's actually very, very taut. But because of that imperative, they sort of shoehorn four songs into it, where literally it is, okay, we're stopping now for a musical interlude.
Yep.
The story will pick back up in a moment.
It's like the films of the 40s when the big band would get a cameo, like Cab Calloway.
Yeah.
Or my favorite, it doesn't really stop the story, but I love Duke Ellington's cameo in Anatomy of a Murder playing piano with Jimmy Stewart. It's just it is one of those things where, okay, a musical interlude, go get popcorn.
Yes, yeah.
All right, next.
61, Wild in the Country.
Another ambitious project. Yeah.
Troubled man, and he's got, I believe, if I remember right, three girls to choose from. So it's a serious version of Spin Out. You have the nice girl, the trashy girl, and I think the teacher, librarian, that, all of them want to help him, or he needs comfort in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
You know, it's not his East of Eden, but it's kind of that troubled youth falling upon.
Well, it's close. He's he's a rejected by his birth family, as it were. And in this one, there are all sorts of, there are evocations of him as a would-be William Faulkner or Thomas Wolfe. He's a Southern writer, although I think the thing is set, has all of these sort of Southern atmospherics, but if I remember right, it's set in New England. So, which means his accent seems, slightly out of place. But, there is a resonance also to that performance as well. But the problem that it had and Flaming Star had is neither one of them did well at the box office.
Yeah, I think that, and that's a shame because,
they made money, but they didn't make tons of money.
Yeah, and that would become a thing that would later anchor the rest of that film. And by the way, shout out to Tuesday Weld.
I've always liked
Tuesday Weld.
Well, and that cast may be the only one that really could stand toe-to-toe with the King Creole cast.
Exactly. So, yeah. All right, next.
Same year, Blue Hawaii.
Well, now the travelogues begin.
Yeah.
First off, the better of the two Hawaiian films by default.
Three Hawaiian
films. Oh, that's right. Three.
Girls. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Of course, my other favorite snarky thing is, of course, his mother. He comes from a wealthy family, but he just wants to live on the beach and have a rock and roll lifestyle, studio version of rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah.
And does not want to deal with Big Daddy or Big Mama. And in this case, Big Mama is played by Angela Lansbury, who apparently was 9 years old when she had her son.
Yeah,
kind of like when she had her son, Lawrence Harvey, at the same age in The Manchurian Candidate.
Yes, yeah. No, it's it's one of those guilty pleasure movies because it really isn't very good in any way. The whole exercise, I guess, at some level is redeemed by the song, most famous song associated with it, Can't Help Falling in Love, which is a classic.
Yes.
And the performance is beautifully modulated and all of that, and sort of became Elvis's anthem, his thank you to his fans.
Correct.
But, the whole thing, he's not believable. The situation is not believable. And you literally can see it's like, okay, we've got however many weeks they take to shoot this thing. How many different Hawaiian backdrops can we work in here? We've paid for these cameras. By God, we're going to use them.
Did they shoot? They shot some of that on location, right?
Yeah, so they did. He did the benefit performance over there at the same time.
That's right.
Yeah.
I have a favorite moment of that was my wife was in the room with me. I was watching it one afternoon, and anytime I can get Lynn to look up from her laptop, just to notice something, it's a big deal. If she hears somebody or she recognizes, she'll kind of stop. And Angela Lansbury's first scene as the kvetching mother, wondering what's wrong with her son, and her and her husband, son and husband shouldn't fight, and she stops writing, watches the scene, And Angela does as best she can and, you know, runs off. And my wife goes back to her laptop and says, even she can't make this crap sound good.
No, no. Well, and it's also the beginning of the truly, the song has become kind of a punchline with several of my friends and me, Rockahula Baby, which and that scene has to be
look it up on
seen,
YouTube.
has to be seen to be believed. And the thing is, I mean, there is something that is oddly moving about watching that, because you can tell at that point the guy was still trying to make it work.
Yep.
You know, he's been handed this, piece of fertilizer. And
I was going to say make chicken salad.
Yeah, he's been here, and he's really trying to make it something watchable. And it's like he narrowly misses and just goes flying off a cliff. So at that point, So I'm not sure I can describe it any more fully than that.
Meanwhile, and that became a story. Like, I don't know how well you know the films of Cliff Richard, which is kind of he's the English Elvis, and it was very, The Young Ones was similar to that. Of he came from a wealthy family, but he wants to, his father is played by Robert Morley. I love cinematic genius.
Yeah.
And they're going to tear down the youth club, so he's going to.
Well, Sean Connery and Harrison Ford.
Sean Connery, Dustin Hoffman, Matthew Broderick, and Family Business. We'll do that later, another show, Cinematic Gene Pools. But yeah, but it's similar, saving the youth center by putting on a show because you're ashamed of your rich lifestyle. So yeah, that's the travelogues begin. Next.
1962, Follow That Dream.
Not as many songs. I don't remember a performance in it.
And a comedic gift.
Is.
Yeah, well, There are several. I mean, he does Follow That Dream, which is one of the better Elvis songs.
Generally, it's like the title track plays over the credits, and that's
He does On Top of Old Smokey.
Oh, gosh,
And a couple of others. But again, it is, and it's a comedy, and he shows some comedic chops there.
Yeah, this was a family that I think they declared the land in Florida their own country, and just wanted to be left alone. And yeah, he's actually good in that.
Well, and it's odd because his character, in some ways the closest point of comparison would be like Jethro on the Beverly Hillbillies, but it's a much more subtle kind of take.
Mm-hmm.
When Max Baer Jr. was doing the whole, he couldn't help kind of winking at the audience, saying, "I'm just playing a character here. I'm really not." Like with Elvis, there was a real kind of sweetness and innocence to the performance that even with something like that, he could have built.
Yep.
He could have built on it.
So we have a little bit of range between the musical stuff and the troubled, the angst-ridden stuff, and then a touch of light comedy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I always remember there was, a famous story that Tom Petty got to meet Elvis because they shot it down in...
Oh, that's right, down in Florida.
Down in Florida. And nice locations. And that was another one. I don't think we saw a lot of the Everglades or the non-beach portions of Florida. Usually that was saved for... Where the Boys Are, the Spring Break movies.
Well, and we're going to get to perhaps one of the great Elvis movie moments in a little while. Another film set in Florida, Clambake.
Yes, we'll get to that.
Where, you look in the concluding scene where Elvis's character proclaims his love for Shelley Fabre's character, and you look over the hero's shoulder and you see mountains, real Florida mountains in the background.
Like the mountains of Muncie, Indiana.
That's
in Close
it.
Encounters,
you got it. You
the
got
Illinois,
it.
The Illinois mountains in The Fugitive, or
you
the mountains
it, yeah.
in Rumble in the Bronx.
Yeah.
Thank you, Vancouver. So,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Next.
62 again. Kid Galahad.
Another
decent film.
Remake of the boxing picture, and your trainer is a non-psychotic Charles Bronson, and. Appears to be non-soused Gig Young.
Yeah.
Decent.
It is. It's actually one of my, favorites to watch because, again, everything seems relaxed. It,
mm-hmm.
The performances are assured. Elvis is believable in character. I gather that the guy who did the training for the boxing. Did not find him particularly gifted, which is a little surprising given all the karate he'd done and the fact that he seemed to be, you know, naturally gifted at movement and all of that sort of stuff. But it doesn't, that doesn't communicate on screen. I mean, the boxing sequences are believable. The romance with Joan Blackman's character is a lot more natural and unforced than they had, you know, like this brother-sister thing going on in Blue Hawaii that was mildly disturbing.
Yes.
And, you know, here it seems much more natural.
Yeah. So underplayed, good bench. Yeah, a well done one. Very good.
Yeah.
Next.
Finishing out 62 with Girls, Girls, Girls.
That's right.
Back to Hawaii.
Back to Hawaii. Stella Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there, after a while...
Is it Stevens is the actor who sort of plays the foil?
I think so. I don't need Elvis in, like, danger or seeking treasure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty good with not having those, which we'll get to later in the decade.
Yeah.
But shoot it on location with pretty girls and kind of throw a story in there as an afterthought.
Well, and it had Return to Sender, another.
Another, that was his last charting hit until 68, 69?
Well, no, because.
Well, major charting.
Yeah, because he, there's an interlude that wasn't associated with the movies. Actually, Crying in the Chapel.
That's right.
Charted in 65. But and it's a Bumps Blackwell song and all of that. You saw far fewer of those top flight songwriters actually being associated with many of these films, too. So in addition to the movies not being as good, the music also wasn't as good. And, you know, and you could tell he was becoming bored with it, too.
Yeah.
It's not one of my favorites. In part, you know, you talk about Elvis looking for treasure. With perhaps one exception, Elvis singing children's songs to children just doesn't seem, you know.
Yeah, we'll get to my daughter in a little bit.
Yeah, well, and it's And you could tell that's another thing they decided, that there was a sequence in G.I. Blues where he did a puppet show and he sang Wooden Heart, which was never a huge hit in the United States, but apparently just exploded in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought, oh, there's money to be made from doing this. So that became sort of the trend of having him repeatedly in films sing to small children.
Thanks, Bean Counters.
Yes.
All right. Next.
1963, It Happened at the World's Fair.
We are continuing our travelogue, the travelogue.
And children again, too.
And children, yes, right. And Yvonne Craig, Batgirl for you guys out there. And he's a crop duster. All crop dusters should look like 60s Elvis Presley.
and have the kind of wardrobes, too.
That's true. Well-dressed crop dusters.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was... I know a little bit about expensive clothing, and I could tell you, you know, the only crops that produce that kind of cash are generally illegal. So.
I think they were the Winter Kills producers.
Yeah.
And I think also wasn't this for a lot of people the introduction to the world? I mean, instead of watching the 10-minute short about the World's Fair, you got a movie about the World's Fair.
Yes. And, you know, it was the Space Needle was relatively new. You got shots of that. You know, about the best I can say about that movie is it isn't the worst of them. But you really began to see a serious slide here, because it's like there's not even a song there ultimately to redeem the
I remember the song Relax. That's the one where he's trying to seduce Yvonne Craig, and she shows a little bit of physical humor, being basically the cat in the Pepe Le Pew cartoons.
Yeah.
The other trivia note, ladies and gentlemen, is and it, at the World's Fair, he falls for a nurse. And
Joan O'Brien.
O'Brien. And in order to get closer to the nurse, he hires a kid. He gives a kid a nickel to kick him in the shins so he can go and see the nurse. And that kid was played by?
Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
Who later played Elvis in a TV miniseries. And the performance, Kurt Russell's performance is phenomenal.
Kurt Russell has acted with Elvis, played Elvis, played an Elvis impersonator, and done voiceover for Elvis in Forrest Gump.
Yes.
So, and there's more Kurt Russell trivia involving this later. So, but otherwise pretty forgettable.
Yeah.
Next.
Fun in Acapulco.
Not shot in Acapulco.
No.
The two things for me with this.
Elvis
and kids. Ursula Andress.
Yeah.
Or as my dad always said, Ursula Undress.
I know.
Because my dad was of a generation.
Yeah.
But when my daughter was into watching Elvis movies, I actually used a scene from I did an anatomy of a scene with Fun in Acapulco because it's the scene where he's a former circus trapeze artist and there was an accident because it's flashbacks and serious music and Elvis goes to the pool and he sees the diving board and and serious music is playing and they cut to Elvis and they cut to the board and then we get a flashback and I talked Emma through this and she's like, oh, you know, I saw her little cinematic light bulb go off and I went, I can't believe we did Anatomy of a Scene, not with Bergman, not with Scorsese or Coppola. No, it was an Elvis movie, and this one of all of them.
Yeah, and this one was probably, that they all fall into there. At this point, with perhaps one, maybe two exceptions going forward, we're talking about misses rather than
same
hits.
Same film three times a year.
Yeah, but this one has a special because it's like the biggest missed opportunity because it is a substantial cast, of attractive and talented rising stars. I mean, Ursula
Andress,
she had just done Dr. No. She was considered a huge emerging talent at that point. Alejandro Rey was in it.
That's right.
He played kind of the foil. He, Elvis had someone to work against who could hold the screen with him. It just didn't work in part because unlike King Creole or even, Blue Hawaii, it's set in Acapulco. And apparently, there was some controversy. Supposedly something had a quote had been misappropriated to him that seemed to denigrate Mexicans and they had security concerns about shooting down there. Although one might wonder, given the Machiavellian nature of the
Colonel Parker's
saying, it's more expensive to go down there. We can shoot in this parking lot right here and everything will be just fine because it's Elvis.
Look up the Colonel's passport. That'll help.
Explain it. Yeah.
All right. Next.
64 Kissin' Cousins.
Oh, this is one of the worst. This is a musical based on the Patty Duke Show.
Yeah.
The army wants a section of some of the hill country, and Elvis is going to help out because he has an identical blonde cousin. And there's a little peak of sadness because you think about his twin dying at birth, and I wondered how much of that, if it any, resonated.
Well, and I think also that movie, conforms to the worst stereotypes of Appalachian whites.
Makes little Abner look like Tennessee Williams.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really, and that's the part of the country, the cultural landscape that my mother's people come from. So, I watched that, and, one presumes with a name like Presley and all of that, that's part of the cultural landscape that he came from. The humor is incredibly forced, and what there is of it, it's always the hill people who are the butt of the joke.
Yep.
Is a reason I think that that he hated making that movie. He hated wearing the wig.
Yeah, there was also I don't remember if they did a split screen like on the Patty Duke show, but there was always somebody, some double with the back to the camera.
Lance LeGault, and there's actually a pretty famous scene near the end of it when they're shooting the big finale.
Okay.
And this was, a production of Sam Katzman, whose nickname was Sam Quickie Katzman,
yes.
Because he did films really, really briskly. And really, really cheaply. And, so the colonel had found his guy there.
Oh, God.
And there is a scene where they're shooting the big finale where everybody's singing, and I think the camera guy missed the shot or whatever, and you can see there's Elvis and there's Lance LeGault standing side by side, and you can tell clearly that it's Lance LeGault. Somebody points it out. Katzman says, no, I don't want to spend the money to get it again. So it goes out that way. The whole thing was shot in 3 weeks.
Oof, gosh, and it shows.
It does.
And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, at the time this film, nobody had planned on home video.
Yeah.
That it was just going to air. And even if somebody had a quick eye and went, is that? You just move on. You couldn't find it again unless it came on TV. And again, you didn't have a pause button.
Well, and the amazing thing is the film that she's going to talk about next, Viva Las Vegas, Call Us On, actually was shot before Kissing Cousins.
It's that they went through it that fast.
And part of it, we'll talk about the implications of this sequence, because this is really the point when Elvis's film career just jumps the rails completely.
And with that in mind, next.
Viva Las Vegas.
Of the frothy comic musicals that he would pump out three times a year, this is the best.
By far.
By far.
By far. It co-stars Anne Margaret.
And we'll get to a couple other actresses, but the last real actress that could stand toe-to-toe when it came to performance, singing, sexuality, comedy. I mean, they bounced off each other really well.
And they had, tremendous chemistry. They had an affair as well, which I gather was sort of a commonplace for him.
An affair with a leading lady.
It's a, as I said to a friend once who was going through a divorce and bought a waterbed and all of that, I said, you're one set of neck chains away from becoming a cliche. in this case, it worked in part because it also, the pacing was incredibly brisk.
Mm-hmm.
You could tell he cared about what he was doing. I think one of the best moments we have of him on film is when he's in that scene where he thinks he has lost Anne Margaret. And, he's not acting. Initially, there's kind of a voiceover performance of a ballad, I Need Somebody to Lean On. But he is conveying all of the confusion and the pain and the hurt and all of that. And you realize, if this guy had been given good material, he could have been something special.
Mm-hmm.
Which gets to your point, about the great might have beens. As much as he accomplished, moments like that tell us that it could have been a heck of a lot more.
And that film did well. It didn't do great. And because because it wasn't a monster hit, Colonel Parker went back to Sam and just started pumping out.
Yeah, there was a lot going on at the point that came out. In part, the Colonel was not on board with having, Elvis share the screen with other strong presences because...
Crazy.
He in fact was complaining all the way through the production that Anne Margaret was getting too much screen time. And all of that. But the other thing that was going on is at this point, Elvis had been the biggest star in music for close to a decade. And he had his first really serious threat. The Beatles had arrived in America.
I remember, what was it? I'm sure there have been several articles, and you can find those of what songs the Beatles were doing that year and what songs Elvis were doing that year, and
mm-hmm.
you see the writing on the wall of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a fun. And by the way, after this one, I'm good with no races, no racing, pretty much for the rest of whatever. Also, with the power of the pause button, they do a really fun duet of What I Say. And in the gymnasium, one of the dancers in the very front, if you push pause, a young Terry Garr.
Yes, she did several of those.
Several of those, yeah. So I don't know. I have to look if she's been interviewed talking about those. I'd like to figure out how she got involved.
I think she was, when she did a David Letterman show years ago, she talked about being in several of the Elvis movies.
Cool, I'll have to find that. So. All right, so yeah, that's one. Here we go. Next.
Roustabout.
I actually like this. It's another example of, apparently Colonel Parker never played tennis.
Yeah.
Because you need somebody equal or better to bounce off of. And he got a chance to work off Barbara Stanwyck, and it's not bad. It's a carnival story about the troubled 20-something working in the carnival. But I like the work he did with Stanwyck.
Yeah, well, and when I watched that film, I can't even remember the actress's name, the young ingenue type that Elvis is supposed to be in love with, in part because even when I watched it when I was young, I thought, why is he chasing after this little girl when Barbara Stanwyck is available? That would have been a bold and
interesting choice. Yep.
To go with that route, and that it shows, one of the big musical moments there is, he does an old R&B hit, Little Egypt, and does it with conviction. It comes back again, obviously, in the 68 comeback special.
Yep.
And I think that album was the last one to go to number one. For him, maybe in the 60s. I mean, even the stuff at American Studios and all of that, I don't think topped the charts. I don't think he got back to number one on the album charts until Aloha from Hawaii.
Wow. There's some good stuff in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yes. Yeah. So. Really good.
Part one of my discussion with John Krull and special moderator McKenna Mays on the films of Elvis Presley. I'll air part two next week. Hey, a couple other movie titles I want you to check out. If you go to filmmovement.com, there is a filmed stage production of Hamlet starring Maxine Peake. And I believe this is the first production of Hamlet with a female Hamlet that has been captured on film. Although I know Diane Vernora did it on stage. I don't know if there's footage of that. But there are lots of ladies playing some of the male roles in this, including Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. So definitely go check this out. It's really cool. Minimalist setting. Really good performances from everybody. Also on Film Movement, Bye Bye Germany, a film about a gentleman determined to get his business going in post-World War II Germany. Selling linens and dealing with trying to move on after what had happened in World War II and trying to make a living of his own while others are saving up their money to go to the United States. Also on video 1-1, which is noted for having Judd Nelson in it, and it's a young girl who, a 20-year-old who is drifting through life and trying to figure out where she wants to go. At first, it seemed like a dystopian tale, but it's more about what is going on in her head. And once it becomes a story of lost youth, it's a decent little low-budget production, and that's available on Blu-ray. And then we have Blue Desert, a Spanish film. I'm sorry, Portuguese. It's from Brazil in 2013. My apologies. Yes, I'm looking at the back. But a guy dealing with what is transcendence in his life. And it looks cool. And there is a Blue Desert moment. But I'm still dealing with stuff here on Earth, yet alone what is transcendent. So not my cup of tea. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people! Zardoz has spoken.
Part two of our epic discussion of the films of Elvis Presley will happen on next week's show. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Go check out Puzzle while it's still at the Art House and go rent First Reformed, one of the best films of 2018. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Pull the string! Pull the string!
No. That's not what I said.
Otto, don't flatter yourself. It wasn't that great.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!